Welcome to Top Advisor Marketing, where you will learn how to become a prolific online influencer, attract more ideal clients, and grow your practice. Brought to you by Top Advisor Podcasting, a done-for-you podcasting solution built just for trusted advisors. And now, your co-hosts of Top Advisor Marketing, Kirk Lowe and Matt Halloran.
Hello and welcome to episode number 70. This is Matt Halloran from Top Advisor Marketing Podcast. We have a very, very special guest today. We're going to be interviewing Daniel Crosby. Now, Daniel has a lot of great stuff to offer us today, but we're going to focus specifically on his newest book, The Laws of Wealth, including the 10 Commandments of Investor Behavior. Now, we have done a lot of podcasts on the cycle of investor emotion, behavioral finance, behavioral economics. But I think what Daniel brings to the table is a very interesting and unique view to this. And by the way, he also has his PhD. Daniel, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much. Great to be here.
Thank you. So here's the kicker. Let's talk about these 10 commandments. And before we really dive into this, where did these come from?
My head, right? The way that I came up with these is I was seeking to develop a behavioral policy statement. So as advisors, we have to give our clients an investor policy statement that says, or an investment policy statement that says, I'm going to act in accordance with, you know, XYZ substrate here when I'm managing your money. And so much of the research that I was getting into showed that more important than the way that we manage clients' money was the way that those clients themselves behave. So I actually created these 10 commandments here to be sort of a short form way to get clients to agree before we engage them that they have to follow rules just as surely as an advisor does.
All right. Well, let's dive into each of these 10 commandments.
Let's do it.
You control what matters most. What do you mean by that?
So one of the things that I come across when working with retail investors is that there is a profound sense of dislocation, of feeling sort of tossed to and fro on the waves of volatility. And as though I often hear the market referred to as sort of gambling, right? Like, oh, that's just like giving your money to Las Vegas. And so what I wanted to do in this first chapter is to distill down the fact that more important than, you know, what the Federal Reserve does, what Donald Trump does, what the economy does, what North Korea does, more important than any of these things, these externalities, is your ability to just do some of the blocking and tackling behavior of setting aside money every month, managing your fees, diversifying your assets, and working with someone who's going to help you cross the finish line. So that was me in the very first chapter, tried to be quite intentional about saying, look, Mr. or Mrs. Investor, you control what matters most. The market, the vagaries of the market aren't as bad as maybe you think, and really, your behavior is the best predictor of whether or not you cross that finish line.
The second commandment just goes right, to me, mentally goes right from that first one, which is you can't do this alone.
Yeah, so it is. I was very intentional about how I positioned, especially those first two commandments, because I think that so often investors fall prey to this illusion that if I know what I ought to do, then I'll just do it. And why do I need help? I'll just save money. I won't work an advisor. I'll just go it alone and use Vanguard or whatever, and I'll be just fine. I think for a small subset of the population that works, but for most people I come across, they absolutely need the help of an advisor, and not for the reasons that they probably think. So a Natixis study a few years back showed that 83% of wealth management professionals thought that the biggest value that they added was hand-holding, coaching, keeping clients from making bad decisions. But when they turn around and ask those clients, you know, what value does your advisor add, only 6% of those clients saw the same behavioral coaching and hand-holding as a value add. So clients have been marketed to by Wall Street that the thing that we're going to do for you is pick outperforming funds, you're going to shoot the lights out. And by virtue of your big returns and our secret knowledge, you're going to get to where you need to go. But I think there's a new day in financial services, and we're beginning to say, look, the value that we add is primarily around handholding and behavioral coaching. And I cite research in that chapter that shows that people who work with an advisor end up being twice as happy and three times as wealthy and twice as happy as their no advice peers. And so I think it's time for us to sort of turn that value proposition on its head.
Word choice is very important. We are a marketing and branding company here at Top Advisor. And the third of the Ten Commandments is trouble is an opportunity. Now, trouble's a powerful word. Explain.
So I'm probably less precise than you are with these things, but trouble is opportunity. So this goes, you know, I think back to a plane flight I was on a couple of months ago, and I sat by a woman on a plane, and she was the gregarious, you know, sort of where are you going, what do you do sort, whereas I'm the like put on headphones and leave me alone sort. But she was very nice, and she was talking to me, you know, what do you do? And I said, well, you know, I'm a doctor of psychology, and I talk to folks about investment behavior. And she goes, you know, you went to 8 years of college to tell people to buy low and sell high, right?
Wow.
And this trouble is opportunity is something that we all know, but that no one does. Like even Charlie Ellis in his book cites the fact that even professional investors, even mutual fund managers, tend to hold their highest cash reserves at the most attractive times to invest and tend to be most invested when forward valuations are the worst. So to me, this trouble is opportunity is all about automating basically the process of Schadenfreude in our own investment lives. I'm a big, big proponent of automation and systematization. And I think that that's the only way we sort of overcome this basic instinct to do the wrong thing at the wrong time.
Number four is if you are excited, it's a bad idea. That's interesting because this plays into the whole emotional aspect of it, right?
Yeah, it absolutely does. So emotions color the way that we assess risk and reward. Someone who's angry feels very certain. You know, anger is a passionate emotion that brings about a lot of certainty. Fear brings about a lot of uncertainty. People who are in a good mood tend to appraise the market as being less risky than people who are in a bad mood. Mm. So I cite research in the book that shows that there's really, really no way for you to make a decision without it being an emotional decision. I cite research on people who have had the emotional processing centers of their brains damaged, and these people can't even pick out, you know, what suit to wear in the morning or what they want to have for breakfast. So we're always going to have an undercurrent of emotion that's part of our investment decision-making process. But what I want us to do is avoid emotional extremes on the one hand to avoid times when we're, you know, extremely greedy or fearful. And then also understand that good investing is really boring investing. I mean, when you think about the things that have sort of made the headlines in recent months, you know, cryptocurrency comes to mind. It's an exciting way to invest, but unfortunately, get rich quick and get poor quick tend to be sides of the same coin. So I'm an advocate for sort of slow and steady, get rich slowly, boring investing.
Number five is brutal. I'm just going to leave it there. Tell us what number five is.
So number five is you are not special. Okay, so this really could have been chapter one, but maybe then no one would have read the rest of the book. So you are not special. You are not special speaks to this tendency for investors to be overconfident. So this is especially problematic with men, which is, you know, surprising to exactly no one. But I cite research in the book where it shows that 94% of men think they're better looking than average, 100% think they're funnier than average, 96% think they're more athletic than average. The researchers go on to conclude that the average man thinks that he's two sit-ups away from dating a supermodel. That was their line. So one of the things that's true of us is that we're overconfident. We tend to walk through the world thinking that we're better than average and that we have better than average luck. And if we take this attitude into financial markets, it leads us to do a couple of things predictably wrong. We under-diversify, we maybe don't work with an advisor, we don't look out for fees, we get too concentrated perhaps in company stock. We do all of these things because we think it can't happen to us. And so one of the things that I want to do in this chapter is disabuse people of this notion that they're special or different and let them know that good investing is rules-based investing and that the best thing that you can do is to proceed as though you are subject to the same laws of gravity and bad luck that everyone else is, because you are.
Number six talks about benchmarking. And as most of us know, benchmarking is something that they do externally from the S&P, the Dow, or anything along those lines. So you have a very different perspective on this. So tell us what number six is, please.
Yeah, so number six is your life is the best benchmark. So you're exactly right. You know, I'm sitting here, my phone is off because I'm talking to you, but I'm sitting here looking at my phone where many, many times a day I check the level of the S&P, right? And I do that even though I know better and I know that I'm not alone there. We benchmark our performance to external benchmarks like the S&P or the Dow or whatever, the NASDAQ, whatever it may be. And this isn't the best way for us to think about our own investing lives. There's a couple of reasons why this is the case. First off, basically no one has the sort of risk tolerance that says that they should be all in equities. And so, you know, comparing to the S&P is just comparing apples to oranges. If you do indeed have a multi-asset class, multinational portfolio the way that you ought to. But there's something that's more behavioral and I think even more powerful here. It's that we have an opportunity to be goals-based investors, to be values-based investors, and to actually name those dollars. So my favorite anecdote from the book, probably my favorite anecdote of the whole book, is a story that was done on low-income savers who were, you know, understandably having trouble setting aside the sort of money they needed for a rainy day. And what happened is the researchers tried carrots and sticks, rewards and punishments. Nothing was working until they showed them a picture of their children and they made them gaze at a picture of their children for 5 seconds before they made a financial decision. And so when they did this, they sort of recentered them, put them back on square one and said, look, what is it all about? What matters to you? And how is this sort of North Star of meaning and purpose going to guide your decisions? And when they did this, savings increased by over 200% by the simple act of having people look at a photo of their children. So I think there's a real lesson here in this, in that if advisors can help their clients keep the eye on the prize, right, to keep focused on what matters the most, I think we can give people some real purpose, help them have more fun along the way, and help them act better as well.
Most financial services professionals do Monte Carlo simulations, which is the back testing of either a current portfolio or a portfolio that they're suggesting. Number seven out of the 10 commandments of the laws of wealth is forecasting is for weathermen. Why don't you elaborate on that for us?
Yeah, so I'll begin with the general concept and then circle back to the specific case of Monte Carlo. So we are one of the only animals that can think about the future in any sort of meaningful way and plan for the future. And that's a good thing mostly. But what it can lead us to do is it can lead us to over-rely on sages and seers who think that they can predict the future. And so we're enormously hungry for this because we really dislike uncertainty and we don't like how hazy the crystal ball can seem. So we are drawn to all manner of soothsayers and charlatans who want to tell us what's going to happen and can weave a compelling story. Well, in this chapter, I look at the research and there's a mountain of it that says basically no one can do this.
Yeah.
And despite the fact that no one can do this, we see fMRI studies, so like brain scans of people who are hooked up to watching financial TV, Mad Money, Jim Cramer's show in particular, in this one study. When they're watching this show and they're receiving sort of a steady stream of financial forecasts, the critical thinking and decision-making part of their brain actually goes to sleep. So this is very soothing to us. It's very soothing to us, and it scratches a very natural human itch. But I want people to get away from forecast-based investing and get tuned into a more systematic, rules-based approach that ignores any sort of prognostication about what's to come and instead focuses on what to do in the here and now. With respect to Monte Carlo in specific, I don't know that I lump them in here so much because
okay.
I think something is better than nothing. But I think what the advisor has to do is help them realize that a forecast is a forecast, right? Because I think people see a Monte Carlo simulation, it seems mathematical, it seems sure, it seems precise, and they go, oh, well, that's what I need. you know, there's a lot of assumptions being made with a Monte Carlo simulation. And I just think we need to be upfront with people about that and qualify it and call it what it is.
Number eight is excess is never permanent. I'm lost on this one. Help me understand this commandment.
So one truism about human nature is that we tend to project the present day into the future sort of indefinitely. So if we're having a good day, it seems like there will just be good days coming forever. And if we're having a bad day, the exact opposite seems to be true. Well, a similar dynamic is at play in financial markets. You know, we see we've had a couple of good years of returns, very good years of returns of late. And you see things like, you know, this week, Southwest crashes an airplane, someone dies, it looks very bad for them, and their stock goes up. That's because I think they're the beneficiary of a sort of broader bullish trend and a broader lens of prosperity, happiness, and bullishness, right? Where the truth is that the truest phrase in all of investing is "this too shall pass." Mm. You know, rather than projecting the present day into the future indefinitely, we should almost project the exact opposite. You know, financial markets are mean reverting in the medium term, meaning that if you've had 3 to 5 years of prosperity, you can say with some certainty that the next 3 to 5 years won't be as good. And on the flip side, if you've had 5 very ugly years, as we did a few years back, you can predict with some certainty that the next 5 years will look quite a bit better. So this is one of the things that, again, runs very contrary to our human nature. We have to condition ourselves to think this too shall pass.
Okay. Give us number nine.
Number nine is diversification means always having to say you're sorry. So this is, of course, a reference to the fact that something in your portfolio should always be underperforming. And that's a very counterintuitive thing to tell people, that something you're holding should always be lagging or doing poorly. Because if it's not, if everything's going up at the same time, that means that everything's likely to drop at the same time. And so diversification is this tricky thing that I think is, you know, widely talked about, poorly understood. And I think that's one of the best sort of rules of thumb is at that quarterly review, is there something that you need to say sorry for? And of course, you know, an advisor doesn't really need to say sorry for doing what's right by his or her clients. But when I find that clients often push back, well, what about this? You know, what about real estate? What about international? Why isn't that keeping up with the S&P? And this just speaks to that and cites everything from ancient texts to the Bible, to ancient Israeli texts, to show that this is a principle that has been around since human history has started to be recorded. And it's one that we'd be wise to embrace more fully.
Let's review the first nine before we jump into the last one, number 10. So would you mind taking this from the top?
I don't mind. So you control what matters most. You can't do this alone. Trouble is opportunity. If you're excited, it's probably a bad idea. You are not special. Your life is the best benchmark. Forecasting is for weathermen. Excess is never permanent. Diversification means always having to say you're sorry. And the last one is risk is not a squiggly line. So this actually refers to sort of the way that mathematicians and academics think about risk. So mathematicians think about risk as volatility. So volatility is the proxy for risk. Basically, the more an asset moves up and down, the riskier it is perceived to be. But I cite evidence that suggests that this isn't true, and I try and turn that argument on its head a bit and say, look, risk in a personal behavioral sense, risk is all about, are you or are you not going to be able to live the kind of life you want to live? So going back to number six about your life being the best benchmark, figure out, really sit down with that advisor, map out the life you want to live, and set up a system whereby you can attain that life through whatever sacrifice on your part is necessary, and set up a system where you can attain that life by taking the minimum risk necessary. Risk isn't the up and down fluctuations of the market, not at all. Risk is the likelihood that you're not going to be able to reach your dreams, and you want to set up a portfolio that gets you there with not 1 ounce more risk than is necessary.
Daniel, our audience is generally financial services professionals. So how can an advisor use your book, or what sort of takeaways would you have from a marketing or communication perspective on for financial advisors based off of your book, The Laws of Wealth?
So first of all, the first part of the book is absolutely set up to provide talking points for advisors.
Oh, wonderful. Yeah.
Yeah. So the first part of the book, that, you know, the things that we've just gone through are absolutely set up to provide proof points for, I think, a lot of things that advisors are saying to people already, but that might ring a little hollow because they are not backed up by science or evidence. So my goal here, I'm the son of a financial advisor, right? So my goal here was to give advisors the scientific tools they needed in an accessible way to say, hey, look, these things that I've been telling you are sound. You know, another thing that I would suggest doing is I think that we as an industry have a responsibility to sort of reorient the way that we talk about the value that we add. In chapter two, I give all kinds of great information on why people who work with advisors hang on to more of their money, are better prepared, are happier, and live more fulfilling lives, like lives writ large, not just financial lives, just lives. And for all of this, despite the fact that we're making people far wealthier and far happier than they were before, financial advisors on trust metrics, like one I saw in Forbes recently, were ranked somewhere between used car salesmen and Congress.
Ouch.
And so, yeah, right? And so we have a lot of work to do, and we need to drop this narrative about being the sort of masters of the universe, the secret gatekeepers of knowledge, and rebrand ourselves, remarket ourselves in a kinder, gentler way that puts reaching purpose and moderating behavior at the top of our to-do list and at the top of our value add list. And this book tries to help make that case on behalf of advisors.
That's awesome. Well, thank you for contributing to the overall thought leadership that our financial services professionals can access to make sure that they are doing that. And you are 100% correct, in my opinion, about the changing of the paradigm. Things are changing. And this is a great way to open up a different sort of conversation, to start changing your clients' behaviors. And also, and Daniel, I don't know if you agree with this, but doesn't this also separate you so much from the advisor down the street?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I think this is a huge point of differentiation. And as I'm sure your listeners are well aware, you know, advisors who have a niche make on average more than three times as much as generalist advisors. Mm-hmm. I think this is the niche to pursue. And, you know, interestingly, this niche, this behavioral niche, is one that's been shown to have a lot of cachet and a lot of appeal to women and to young people. This message really tends to resonate with women and young people who are sort of these elusive groups that are commonly underserved by financial professionals. Mm-hmm. So I think it's a differentiator. I think it's a way to serve underserved populations that will be coming into a lot of wealth as old guys die off.
Wonderful. You know what? I want to leave you with "and old guys die off." That's one of the best closings to a podcast I think I've ever done.
My pleasure to help you close it out so tactfully.
That was awesome. Hey, what's the best way for people to get in touch with you if they want to know more about this?
People can buy the book on Amazon. They can reach out to me on Twitter at Daniel Crosby or hunt me down on LinkedIn.
Wonderful. Well, Daniel, thank you very, very much for your time today. We appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thank you.
And if you have not subscribed to this podcast yet, make sure you click the subscribe now button below. That way, every time we come out with a new podcast, it'll show up directly on your listening device. So for Daniel Crosby and for everybody actually at Top Advisor Marketing, thank you very much for listening. And if you too love the idea of podcasting, make sure you reach out to us and see what you can do to start your own. With that, thank you. And we'll see you on the other side of the mic very soon.
Are you ready to change the way you communicate with your clients? Are you tired of being the best kept secret in your area? Learn how to become a prolific online influencer, attract more ideal clients, and grow your business. Contact us today and see what the power of podcasting can do for your business. Click on the Contact Us link on our website at topadvisormarketing.com and set up a call to learn more. Follow us on LinkedIn and Facebook for more updates and information.